We are delighted to say that we've once again been selected by the Big Give for this year's Green Match Fund, which means every donation we receive will be doubled. This time around, we're raising funds for our science and research work, and we're hoping to raise £10,000, and the Big Give would match each donation made. Donations must be received via the Big Give website, which will go live on the 18th of April and will remain open for 1 week only until the 25th of April. Every donation will make a difference. We've put a link to the donation page in the show notes.
Hello and welcome to Bat Chat, the podcast from the Bat Conservation Trust, where we're talking to both experts and local heroes to bring you the stories from the bat conservation movement. Thanks for downloading this week's episode. We hope you enjoy it. I'm Steve Rowe, and we're halfway through this series of Bat Chat. Now, last year, before we had even heard of the word coronavirus, the world was a very different place, with conferences taking place in person and people enjoying networking with each other to learn of the latest studies and conservation work being done with our bat species. One such conference, which takes place each year, is the Scottish Bat Conference, which last took place in Perth last November, and in this episode we have three guests from that event. On the day of the conference, I spoke with Sue Swift, who wrote the infamous monograph on long-eared bats, which, despite being published in 1998, is still in high demand, and with Tracy Jolliffe, who is a rehabber of poorly bats, but also has a keen interest in zoonotic and anthropogenic infections. But before that, on the eve of the conference, I caught up with the Bat Conservation Trust's Scottish Bat Officer, Liz Ferrell, who had been spending the afternoon getting things ready in the conference centre, ready for the following day. So it's the day before the Scottish Bat Conference, and I'm sat in a bar, relaxing, with the Scottish Bat Officer and a load of other BCT staff.
Oh, goodness.
Liz, how long have you been the Scottish Bat Officer for BCT?
It sounds like I've been the Scottish Officer too long in a bar. It sounds a bit wrong here. No, it's all above board. I've been the Scottish Officer for just over 2 years now. So started in July 2017.
What was your job background? What were you doing before this?
So I did a degree, University of Glasgow, zoology degree, and after that I worked for the Scottish Wildlife Trust for 6 months. I then did a bit of consultancy, so that was for a year, and that was my short history before BCT.
And why bats? What was it that made you move away from all that stuff and move into bats?
There just hasn't really... I mean, I love all wildlife, but when I was on holiday in Wales and I saw a roost emergence, pipistrel roost emergence, I've just never really felt like that before when I've watched wildlife. They were just swooping right above my head and I just thought, wow, they're really quite magical and intriguing, and I just instantly then wanted to learn more about them. And yeah, it's just my kind of, I've just got this fascination with them. They're so intriguing and there's so much still to learn. It's just, yeah.
What does the BCT Scottish Bat Officer do? What do you get involved with job-wise?
Oh, goodness. It's very wide-ranging. So for people that maybe don't know, I'm the only employee based in Scotland. So it is a wide-ranging role. I help support the Scottish Bat groups, so the volunteer groups here in Scotland, whether that be with their own individual projects, whether that be training, for instance delivering a Scottish conference, and obviously I know the main other part of my role is then working closely with the National Bat Wanting Programme team down in London and delivering that up here, so again giving training to volunteers so that they can undertake these surveys.
And you mentioned Scottish bat groups there. How many bat groups are there in Scotland?
So,
putting you on the spot.
I should know. There's one that's just gone into hibernation, unfortunately, though I'm sure they will kickstart at some point in the future. So I think at the moment we've now got 11 okay. active groups.
And why does BCT put these regional conferences on?
There's a variety of reasons, but the main one is to have some sort of event where bat workers can come together, you know, particularly in Scotland, you know, where bat workers are so spread apart, and it's just nice to have one event in the year where we can kind of all come together, catch up, but also, you know, learn something about bats. And certainly I've already learnt a few things ahead of the conference tomorrow. Obviously I've had a look at a few of the presentation slides already, cheekily, and I've already learnt some new things. So yeah, I think it's just bringing people together and actually just sharing some updates on bats as well.
So how many bat workers from Scotland will come to tomorrow's conference?
We have 115 booked on, and that is pretty typical. What's nice, that's a good number to have all together.
And how much work goes into organising a conference like this?
So I am quite particular. I do keep a really good timesheet, actually, so I can tell you exactly. It's 24 days of my time, and obviously that is spread across quite a few months.
So a lot of work then.
So yeah, it is quite a chunk of my work, yeah.
And obviously we'll be hearing more tomorrow, but is there much bat research taking place in Scotland? Because most of it's, you know, upland areas, highlands, areas like that. It's quite sparse, barren landscape.
Yeah, and, you know, if you'd asked me kind of 2 months ago, oh, you know, there's so many gaps. But actually when I dig in to area as well, I actually find that there has been work done. It's just, you know, the data storage and actually knowing what has been done, that can be the tricky bit. But no, I mean, it is a thing. With the area being so remote, population levels being low, there is lots of gaps across our highlands, but not just the highlands, you know, other areas as well in Scotland.
And a big feature of Scotland is obviously all the islands on the north and the western coasts. What about those islands? Of those ones that have been surveyed, are there bats there, or do we really not know that much about them?
Yeah, so again, if you'd asked me a year ago, I would have been like, ah, there's been nothing done. And I've actually spent a bit of time this summer going to some of the islands. And Isla, as an example, Paul Racy had done some work on the island before, found out that he'd monitored a natter's roost on the island. And actually our islands are really, really great for bats from what I can tell so far. Some of them have as many as six species. Obviously the more far-flung ones is the hardy common pipistrelle, but no, there's quite a bit of diversity on there.
So presumably if people are coming to Scotland on holiday, would it be useful to get their records from them?
Definitely, yes. You know, we want long-term trends, so repeat sites over and over. That is really important data, but the more ad hoc information is still really useful for us. So yeah, definitely, you know, get recording.
And how many bat species are present in Scotland?
So I always say 10. Brants is the question mark one. There was a single bat dropping sent off for DNA analysis from Galloway Forest, and it came back as Brants. So let's say 10. Let's be optimistic. Maybe we just need to do a bit more work and find out.
Are there any unusual roosts that are known from Scotland? Anything that stands out?
Well, oh goodness, there was a few. I guess the islands, again, you know, that's just a personal interest of mine. The one on Isla is interesting, Nasser's roost, and from the photo I've seen, it's a sizeable roost, 50 plus maybe individuals. And then I look at the habitat round about and I think, oh, it looks quite barren, it's quite open. And I think, goodness, how do they actually survive? And then doing some radio tracking work, there's then also, you know, 2,000 bats in a Galloway, someone's house, and they've moved out of their own bedroom because they like the bats so much. I think, wow, that was an incredible roost to visit. You did lose count on that one.
And if there are Scottish residents listening to this who would like to get involved in bat conservation or come along to an event to see what it's all about, where's the best place for them to go and get more information about that?
Certainly, you know, just look locally at your kind of events page. There's so many activities happening, bat walks happening, and whether it is a bat group or you know, it could be your Scottish Wildlife Trust, RSPB. There's bound to be something done locally. We certainly keep a lot of information on our website as well of events that we are aware of. But certainly, first step is definitely to see if there's a local bat group in your area.
Cool. Good luck for tomorrow.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
So it's the following day and the Scottish conference is well underway, and we're in the first coffee break, and I've managed to grab a few minutes with Sue Swift. And Sue is probably best known for publishing
her monograph on long-eared bats, which was published back in 1997. So what has your career with bats been? Where have you worked? What have you even been involved with over your time as a bat worker?
Seem to have been at it forever, actually. Started back as an undergraduate in 1976 in Aberdeen, when Paul Racy was just getting bat ecology established. I did an undergrad project with him, and then we followed that up with the first major field study of ecology and behaviour of bats in Scotland, and that took us 3 years. I followed that up 30 years as a research fellow on and off in the University of Aberdeen. After the initial study, I really went on to more conservation biology type things. I did the first study really on the effects of timber treatment chemicals in bats. We were able to show how damaging things like lindane were, and were instrumental in getting chemicals based on permethrin to replace them. After that, I did a variation of projects. My favourite one was on how gleaning bats, I've always been fascinated by gleaning bats and how they work. Working with a German colleague, we did a project on how these gleaning bats perceive their prey, how they capture their prey, and how their echolocation structure matches with their morphology to allow them to glean. It was absolutely amazing project, and also enabled me to keep little colonies of gnatterers and brown long-eared bats in a flight room, which I found utterly fascinating. It was beginning of a lifelong love affair with these bats. I've also worked on a project to design and build heated bat houses as mitigations for replacing lost pipistrel roosts. And my latter part of my research career was on sampling and testing bats for EBLV viruses in Scotland, which took us 8 years as a major project sponsored by SNH. At the same time as all this, I was doing consultancy part-time. I was one of the first consultants in Scotland. And I did that full-time from about 2010 until I retired 2 years ago, and found some very interesting projects in that too. So it's been an amazing life with bats.
I was going to say, it's only a small amount of things then. So, in 2009, you were the first woman to receive the Pete Guest Awards. How did that feel, and do you think the gender balance in bat workers has been restored now?
Well, the first thing I'd say, I was very surprised to win it, and I was also very honoured to win it. It didn't actually occur to me at the time that I was the first woman to win it. I was kind of used to being one of the very few women in bats and research. But yes, the gender balance has undoubtedly been restored. Women more than hold their own in bat conservation at the moment, and we have a very, very worthy winner this year. So yes, I think the answer is it definitely has, yeah.
And what was it that made you write the monograph for the long-eared bats? Where did it come out of?
There was a colleague, actually, who was asked to write one on pipistrels and for some reason turned it down, but said, oh, if you want a good one on brown long-eared long-eared bats, just go and ask Sue Swift. So I was sort of trapped into doing it. At the time, I had a lot of other things in my life and didn't realise how long a book would take. But I'm really glad I did it, in that it pulled together all the research at the time. It was fascinating to write, and it was an achievement.
And it's something that's still referred to now. I mean, I've got a copy of my shelf and I still refer to it even now.
So. I read it actually before this podcast. I hadn't read it for years. And it still holds up remarkably well. So, yes, I'm quite proud of that.
And just in a bit of a crash course, which I know is difficult in the time we've got, but can you just tell us a bit more about the ecology of long-eared bats?
Well, I've written down just a few things because, as I say, that you could spend a lifetime on this. They're small bats. They're, in case of brown long-eared bats, they're relatively common and widespread in Britain. They live in houses. They're one of the most recognisable species and the best known to the public. They live in small colonies. They fly slowly. They have huge ears. They forage by gleaning, mainly in woodland. They use their big ears to listen for prey sounds. They echolocate very quietly, which makes it difficult to pick them up on bat detectors. They mate in autumn and winter. They hibernate in trees, buildings and caves. They produce one young a year, and the young learn to fly in the roost. Although our two British species are very similar to look at, they have noticeable differences in their ecology and behaviour, which makes them fascinating to learn. They also do this speciation. There's lots of different now. The more we see of genetics, the more we realise how many different species of long-eared there are, which is another story altogether, but fascinating.
And you've mentioned gleaning a couple of times now. Just for listeners at home who don't know what that is, can you just quickly explain that for us?
Gleaning is taking prey at rest from surfaces rather than catching it aerially. So they could be crawling along the ground and picking it up, or hovering above trees and picking it up, or foraging right in among the bushes and just grabbing insects off the vegetation. You need to be able to fly slowly to do it, obviously, and you need to be able to detect the prey, which is the really interesting thing in clutter.
And that's why they've got such wide wing membranes, isn't it? So they can actually slow down.
Yes, indeed. They have low wing loading, and they can hover, and they fly very slowly, which you can only do if you've got very broad wings.
Now, lots of you have seen me in branded T-shirts and hoodies with the Bat Chat logo on, and you've all been asking me when they'll be available. Well, we're thrilled to let you know that a whole range of Bat Chat clothing and tote bags is now available for you on our T-Mill store. The link's in the show notes. Whether you're a long-time supporter or a new member of the Bat Chat family, we can't wait for you to share your photos of you wearing our merch on social media. Be sure to tag the Bat Conservation Trust in your posts. If you're listening to Bat Chat on Google Podcasts, we wanted to let you know that Google have announced they plan to discontinue their app later this year. So we recommend making the switch to an alternative podcast app, and we've put some links in the show notes to alternative apps that you can follow Bat Chat on so that you don't miss any future episodes.
And something that's quite typical of finding long-eared roosts is finding evidence of their feeding perches. What moth species is so big that long ears need to hang up and eat it?
Well, I was actually thinking about that. And yeah, when you're an 8-gram bat, most moth species are quite big. Your average noctuid moth, which is what a lot of the ones we get certainly up here are, weighs between 100 and 150 milligrams. Now, that to an 8-gram bat is roughly equivalent to you having to, at full pelt, catch a live chicken, catch it, kill it and eat it. So it's not surprising they use these. Also, moths tend to be quite physically big. Therefore, they need their thumbs to process it, to manipulate it, to get the nasty, chewy bits off, which is why they use these. They're not all moths by any means. I mean, you tend to notice things like large yellow underwings because they tend to be in heaps. But in fact, if you look under a perch, you'll find a lot of other things. I've found remains of a lot of things like small chafer beetles, which they trim the elytra and the legs off, even large lace wings and a variety of other moths as well. So they take probably most of their larger prey to these little perches, which are often in a porch or a barn or something, somewhere they can get in easily. And they also use them to have a little rest and a groom and maybe, you know, just think what they're doing.
The wings that we're seeing are only those that they're taking back to the feeding perch. Presumably they're eating a whole range of other species as well that we don't get to see.
Exactly. Early studies way back in the 20s, dietary studies on these bats were entirely done through feeding perches, which led to the sort of the myth, if you like, that they are totally moth specialists. But in fact, once we started doing fecal analysis on them, we find they eat a large range of insects. They tend to eat about 40% moths, brown long-eared, but they'll also eat a wide variety of things, flies, crane flies, earwigs, spiders and apiliones, things like that. So yes, which you don't get under the perches.
And you said in your book it would seem logical to assume that brown long-eared are brown and grey long-eared are grey, but it's not that simple, is it?
No, it's never that simple, is it? Young brown long-eared have a sooty grey colour and they stay grey for about a year, and there's a huge variation in it. So telling one from the other is really quite a problem, but there are factors you can use, and the experts on grey long-eared tell me that the best ways to do it is not to look at the hair colour, but to look at the banding along the hairs. So you blow gently on the dorsal fur of the bat, and the grey long-eared tend to be universally dark grey, whereas the brown long-eared have sort of stripy zones, a pale zone and then a darker one and then a pale one. That's a good way to tell them. face colour is much more reliable than hair colour. So if your bat's got a dark brown, almost black face, it's probably a grey long-eared. If it's got a browny pink face, it's a brown long-eared. Tragus shape is very distinctive, whereas it's long and thin in the brown long-eared. It's straight in at the front and then with a distinct convex loop in the grey long-eared. And the final one is that brown long-eareds are slightly smaller bats, although there's a lot of overlap, but they have long, thin thumbs. So the way to do it is to measure the thumb length, measure the forearm length, and then take the ratio. It's much higher in brown long-eared bats, and that separates them completely. If anyone ever has to do it, it's about 19% in brown long-eareds and 14% in greys. And that takes account of the individual size variation in bats as well.
And why are the ears of long ears so large?
Just very briefly, for those who don't know about the evolutionary arms race. Initially, when there were no mammals, insects were deaf because they didn't have to hear. Then in the Eocene, when the bats came along, they began to develop these hearing organs, which aren't ears as we imagine them. They can be anywhere on a palp or on a wing or something. The moth species which have them are the Notodontidae, the Noctuidae, Geometridae, Arctiidae and Pyralidae. So quite a range of moth species have these hearing organs. Green lacewings have got them, plus some beetles, including some tiger beetles, dung beetles, and in the tropics, mantises, field crickets and some hemipteran bugs. Now, what happens is that the reason long-eared bats' ears are so big, it's been found that they act as an acoustic horn and they magnify sounds at low frequencies. And the best frequency that a long-eared bat's ear can detect and magnify is 12 kilohertz, which is exactly the frequency at which a moth's wings flutter. So because the moths can hear the bats coming, what these bats have done is they echolocate very, very quietly anyway. So they can actually just drop it almost to the point where they can't hear themselves, and then they just listen for the fluttering sounds. And because they're so manoeuvrable, so easy, they can get right down in among it. They can just go in. I've even seen them walking along the ground grabbing moths. And that's why they're one of the few bats in Britain that actually can specialise on moths. And moths are good. They're juicy, they're soft, they're quite easy to catch. And importantly, they fly all night, so you're not restrained like a pipistrelle is by the dusk and dawn insect beaks.
And what about the mating strategies? There's this idea that long-eared bats do swarm in the autumn, but when we're doing the studies, we're finding that actually the most common species are natteras, and yet we know that long-eared are the second most common species, so the numbers don't seem to stack up.
There is some evidence that this is one of the main differences between the two species, that I'll look at the grey long-eareds first, which are quite aggressive bats, and they tend to mate in the autumn only and in the nursery roosts. You tend to get one male to a group of females. So it looks like what they're actually doing, a classic female resource strategy. One male is guarding these females. But the brown long-eared bats have a different way of doing it. And because they mate all in the autumn and all winter, they mate intermittently all winter, a male couldn't guard all the females. Therefore, it looks like they have a random promiscuous mating system. But it seems to be less at swarming sites and more taking place in the maternity roost right at the end of the summer. So they do swarm, but probably not in the sites where you're looking for them, which is where the myotis bats swarm.
In the 20 years since your monograph on long-eared was published, several new exciting research techniques have been developed, such as cheap DNA testing, full spectrum detectors, radio tags, the thermal imaging stuff we've just seen in the last session. If you could have had just one of today's techniques back then, which one would you choose and why?
Well, I was going to say really good radio tags for some of my early work, but we saw a brilliant talk this morning on high-definition thermal imaging. I would have loved to have had that. Radio tags, I think, would have been fantastic. On the other hand, improvements in DNA analysis now looks as though my particular skill in fecal analysis is going to be redundant. We can simply put the droppings through a machine and it'll tell us exactly what it ate. So the future is very bright and we're going to find out a lot more.
And what do we know now about long-eared bats that we didn't know 20 years ago, and what has surprised you most?
I think the most interesting and probably surprising feature is their ability to produce all these sibling species. What looked like one long-eared species in the 50s in the whole of Europe is now about 5 or 6, because every time they do more DNA, they find that there are more sibling species and that they're speciating fantastic. I think that's an amazing thing to find out, and somewhere we're going.
Sue, that's been a fascinating insight. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
So it's the afternoon session here at the conference, and I've grabbed a few minutes with Tracy Jolliffe. Tracy, what is your background in rabies or medicine? What's your job at the moment?
I originally started as a veterinary nurse, and I did that for quite some time, and then went to university as a mature student and retrained as a microbiologist. So I've done both bacteriology and virology, and I've also done 3 years in the rabies research labs down in Weybridge.
So, first question, what is rabies?
Rabies is a viral infection. It's been around for a long time. We've got references going back thousands of years to what was probably rabies infections, although it's not named as such. And viruses, the difference between viruses and bacteria is that viruses are true parasites. They have to actually infect cells in order to replicate, whereas bacteria are free-living organisms, and they can live and replicate on all sorts of innate objects. They don't need human or animal cells.
And what's the history of rabies in bats?
Rabies has probably been in bats for thousands and thousands of years. Nobody's going to be completely sure about that. In terms of bats in the UK, the first bat we had with rabies was a Dorbentans on the south coast, and that was back in the mid-80s. And first of all, we thought it was probably just a migrant. You know, it'd come over either assisted passage on a ship or just flown the short distance over the channel. So we weren't too worried about it. But then a few years later, we found a juvenile Dorbentans in Lancashire, and that was when we realised that we actually had it endemic in some of our bats.
And which species have been confirmed to have it so far?
In the UK, it's primarily Dorbentans. That's where most of the cases are. And recently, we've had a few cases in Ceratines on the south coast.
We hear about European bat lyssavirus type 1 and type 2. What's the difference between type 1 and 2?
It's really just a genetic variation. There are 18 different species of rabies virus, and they split into different groups. And European bat lyssavirus 1 and 2 are both fairly closely related to classical rabies, which is genotype 1.
As bat workers, we hear about having pre-exposure vaccinations as being important, but that guidance is slightly changing with Public Health England at the moment. Are gloves still the best first and fore line of defence?
Absolutely. There's something called a chain of infection that all infections follow, and there have to be all these different things in place in order to one infection go from one organism to another, and what we're worried about is from a bat to a human. So you just have to break that chain of infection at one point, and the easiest way to not get rabies is not get bitten. So learning how to handle bats correctly is very important, and wearing gloves, because it doesn't matter what your vaccination status is, if you're not going to get bitten, then you're not going to get rabies. It's as simple as that.
And why is it that bats can cope with the virus? And are there any cases of humans having survived rabies exposure without vaccination?
We think that bats are the original host for rabies, and one of the reasons is probably, although it's never been confirmed, is that bats are a very ancient group of animals. They've been around in their current form for a very long time, so we think that they've just evolved to live with the viruses, because they are renowned for carrying lots of different viruses that they cope with fine, but if they spill over into other species can cause quite serious problems.
Obviously rabies doesn't get a great press given the severity of the consequences of it going undetected in humans. As bat workers, is there anything that we can do to improve the image of bats having rabies?
I think we just need to supply the facts to people. I mean, rabies is a huge problem globally, but 99% of rabies cases across the world are from dogs. So that is the huge reservoir that we need to be concerned about from a global point of view. So rabies in terms of bats. It's a very small percentage of one or two species in the UK, so I think we need to emphasise that. It's, even if you come across that species, the chance of them having rabies is still going to be very small. And just emphasise the fact that we do take precautions. You know, there is an effective vaccine, and wearing gloves and correct handling is going to prevent people from being exposed in the first place.
Great stuff. Tracy, thank you very much.
Cool.
My thanks to Liz, Sue and Tracy for taking time out of the conference last year to come on the show. The various links to their social media accounts are in the show notes. And the 2021 Scottish Bat Conference is taking place online on Saturday the 6th of March. And bookings for that event are now open on the BCT website. And again, the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoyed this episode, why not share with us what your favourite ever encounter with a long-eared bat has been by using the hashtag BatChat. That's it for this episode, but we will be back in 2 weeks' time in the new year with the Chief Exec of the Bat Conservation Trust, Kit Stoner, who will be revealing what it's like to run BCT as an organisation, and will also be giving us the latest news on the status of the British Bat Survey, an upcoming nationwide project, so don't miss it. Everyone here at the Bat Conservation Trust wishes you all the very best for the festive period, whatever you're doing this year, and we look forward to sharing more stories with you from the world of bats in the new year. Thank you to Wildcare and Wildlife Acoustics for sponsoring the Bat Chat podcast.
Can you hear that?
We can. Wildlife Acoustics creates the world's leading bat acoustic monitoring tools, designed to help scientists make impactful discoveries for our biologically diverse planet, turning this into this. Visit wildlifeacoustics.com to learn more.
Wildcare are committed to supporting the ecology industry and are specialists in supplying a large range of monitoring, conservation and habitat management products, as well as equipment hire and service and repair. With a large range of products coupled with friendly and expert help and advice, Wildcare is a favourite supplier for ecologists nationwide. Go to wildcare.co.uk to see the full range and quote BatChat at the checkout for 10% off all bat detectors and bat boxes.